The Computational Metaphor. Rodney A. Brooks, Emeritus Panasonic Professor of Robotics, MIT, Founder, Chairman, and CTO, Rethink Robotics. Author, Flesh and Machines. Throughout history, we have used technological systems as metaphors to describe how the body and brain might work. Ancient Greek water technology led to the four humors and the idea that they must be kept in balance. By the 18th century, clock mechanisms and flows of fluids were used as metaphors for what happened in the brain. By the first half of the 20th century, a common metaphor for the brain was a telephone switching network. Indeed, the mathematics developed for signal propagation in telegraph and telephone wires was used to model action potentials in axons. By the 1960s, cyberneticians were using models of negative feedback, originally developed for the steam engine and greatly expanded during the Second World War for controlling the aiming of guns, to try to develop models for the brain. But these soon ran out of steam, so to speak, and were supplanted by metaphors of the brain as a digital computer. We started to hear claims of the brain as the hardware and the mind as the software, a model that didn't much help our understanding of either brain or mind. Throughout the later 20th century, the brain became a massively parallel digital supercomputer, and now you can find claims that the brain and the World Wide Web are similar in how they work, with web pages and neurons playing similar roles and hyperlinks and synapses mapping to each other. This suggests that metaphors for the brain will continue to evolve as technology evolves, with the brain always corresponding to the most complex technology we currently possess. But does the metaphor of the day have an effect on the science of the day? I claim that it does, and that the computational metaphor leads researchers to ask questions today that will one day seem quaint at best. The power of computation and computational thinking is immense, and its import for science is still in its infancy. But it's not always helpful to confuse computational approximations with computational theories of a natural phenomenon. For instance, consider a classical model of a single planet orbiting a sun. There's a gravitational model, and the behavior of the two bodies can easily be explained as the solution to a simple differential equation describing forces and accelerations and their relationships. The equations can be extended for relativity and for multiple planets, and instantaneously those equations describe what a physicist would say is happening in the system. Unfortunately, the equations have become insoluble by this point, and the best we can do to understand the long-term behavior of the system is to use computation, where time is cut into slices and a digital approximation to the continuous description of the local behaviors is used to run a long-term simulation. However, only the most die-hard of computationalists, and they do exist, would claim that the planets themselves are computing what to do at each instant. We know that it's more fruitful to continue to think of the planets as moving under the influence of gravity. When it comes to explaining the brain and simpler neural systems, the computational metaphors have taken over. We hear people talk about neural coding. What is it that's coded in the spike train running along an axon over time? But early neurons evolved to synchronize muscle activity better. For instance, jellyfish swim much better if all their swimming muscle activates at once, so that they go straight rather than wobble, and evolution found multiple solutions in different species for this problem. The solutions range from really fast spike propagation to carefully tuned attenuation of signals along the triggering axon and local delays at the muscle fibers dependent on spike strength. Furthermore, in many jellyfish, there are multiple neural systems based on different propagation chemistries for different behaviors, and even for different modes of swimming. Just as describing planets as computational systems isn't the best way to understand what's going on, thinking of neurons in these simple systems as computational systems sending messages to one another isn't the best way to describe the behavior of the system and its environment. The computational model of neurons of the last 60-plus years excluded the need to understand the role of glial cells in the behavior of the brain or the diffusion of small molecules affecting nearby neurons or hormones as ways that different parts of neural systems affect each other or the continuous generation of new neurons or countless other things we haven't yet thought of. They didn't fit within the computational metaphor, so for many they might as well not exist. The new mechanisms we do discover outside of straight computational metaphors get pasted onto computational models, but it's becoming unwieldy. And worse, that unwieldiness is hard to see for those steeped in its traditions, racing along to make new publishable increments to our understanding. I suspect we'll be freer to make new discoveries when the computational metaphor is replaced by metaphors that help us understand the role of the brain as part of a behaving system in the world. I have no clue what those metaphors will be, but the history of science tells us they'll eventually come along.
Left brain, right brain. Sarah Jane Blakemore, Royal Society University Research Fellow, Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience, University College London, co-author with Uta Frith, The Learning Brain. Most people will have heard about the left brain, right brain idea. Maybe they've been told they're too left-brained and they want to be more right-brained. The idea has made it into everyday parlance, has infiltrated schools everywhere, sells a lot of self-help books, and has even been used as the basis of scientific theories, for example, regarding gender differences in the brain. Yet it's an idea that makes no physiological sense. Scientific lingo about how the two sides of the brain, the hemispheres, function, has permeated mainstream culture, but the research is often overinterpreted. The notion that the brain's two hemispheres are involved in different modes of thinking, and that one hemisphere dominates the other, has become widespread, in particular, in schools and the workplace. There are numerous websites where you can find out whether you're left-brained or right-brained, and which offer to teach you how to change this. This is pseudoscience, and not based on knowledge of how the brain works. While it's true that the brain is made up of two hemispheres, and one hemisphere is often initially active before the other during actions, speech, and perception, both sides of the brain work together in almost all situations, tasks, and processes. The hemispheres are in constant communication with each other, and it simply isn't possible for one hemisphere to function without the other joining in, except in certain rare patient populations. In other words, you're not right or left-brained. You use both sides of your brain. Some have proposed that education currently favors left-brain modes of thinking, which are supposed to be logical, analytical, and accurate, and doesn't put enough emphasis on right-brain modes of thinking, which are supposed to be creative, intuitive, emotional, and subjective. Certainly, education should involve a wide variety of tasks, skills, learning, and modes of thinking. However, it's just a metaphor to refer to these as right-brain or left-brain modes. Patients who have had a lesion in their right hemisphere aren't devoid of creativity. Patients with a damaged left hemisphere might be unable to produce language, which relies on the left hemisphere in over 90% of the population, but can still be analytical. Whether left-brain, right-brain notions should influence the way we educate is highly questionable. There's no validity in categorizing people, in terms of their abilities, as either left-brained or right-brained. Such categorization might even act as an impediment to learning, not least because it might be interpreted as innate or fixed to a large degree. Yes, there are individual differences in cognitive strengths, but the idea that people are left-brained or right-brained needs to be retired.
Left Brain, Right Brain. Stephen M. Kosselin, psychologist, founding dean, Minerva Schools, Keck Graduate Institute. Co-author with G. Wayne Miller, Top Brain, Bottom Brain. Solid science sometimes devolves into pseudoscience, but the imprimatur of being science nevertheless may remain. No better example of this is the popular left-brain, right-brain narrative about the specializations of the cerebral hemispheres. According to this narrative, the left hemisphere is logical, analytic, and linguistic, whereas the right is intuitive, creative, and perceptual. Moreover, each of us purportedly relies primarily on one half-brain, making us left-brain thinkers or right-brain thinkers. This characterization is misguided, and it's time to put it to rest. Two major problems can be identified at the outset. First, the idea that each of us relies primarily on one or the other hemisphere is not empirically justifiable. The evidence indicates that each of us uses the whole brain, not primarily one side or the other. The brain is a single interactive system whose parts work in concert to accomplish a given task. Second, the functions of the two hemispheres have been mischaracterized. Without question, the two hemispheres engage in some different kinds of information processing. For example, the left preferentially processes details of objects we see, whereas the right preferentially processes the overall shape of objects we see. The left preferentially processes syntax, the literal meaning. The right preferentially processes pragmatics, the indirect or implied meaning, and so forth. Our two hemispheres aren't like our two lungs. One isn't a spare for the other, redundant in function. But none of these well-documented hemispheric differences come close to what's described in the popular misconception. It's time to move past the incorrect left-brain, right-brain narrative. Moore's Law. Andrian Kreye, editor, The Feuilleton, Arts and Essays, of the German daily Süddeutsche Zeitung, Munich. Gordon Moore's 1965 paper stating that the number of transistors on integrated circuits will double every 2 years has become the most popular scientific analogy of the digital age. Despite being a mere conjecture, it has become the go-to model to frame complex progress in a simple formula. There are good technological reasons to retire Moore's Law. For example, the consensus that it will effectively cease to exist past a transistor size smaller than 5 nanometers, which would mean a peak and sharp drop-off in 10 to 20 years. Another is the potential of quantum computers to push computing into new realms. They're expected to become reality in 3 to 5 years. But Moore's Law should be retired before its technological limits, because it has sent the perception of progress in the wrong direction. Treating its end as an event would just amplify the errors of reasoning. First and foremost, Moore's Law has led us to see the development of the digital era as a linear narrative. The simple curve of progression is the digital equivalent of the ancient wheat and chessboard problem, with a potentially infinite chessboard. Like the Persian inventor of the game of chess, who demanded from the king a geometric progression of grains all across the board, digital technology seems to develop exponentially. This model ignores the parallel nature of digital progress, which encompasses not only technological and economic development, but scientific, social, and political change, changes that can rarely be quantified. Still, the Moore's Law model of perception has already found its way into the narrative of biotechnological history, where change becomes ever more complex. Proof of progress is claimed in the simplistic reasoning of a sharp decline in cost for sequencing a human genome. From $3 billion in the year 2000 to the August 2013 cancellation of the Genomics X Prize for the first $1,000 genome because the challenge had been outpaced by innovation. For both digital and biotechnical history, the linear narrative has been insufficient. The prowess of the integrated circuit has been the technological spark to induce a massive development comparable with the wheel allowing the rise of urban society. Both technologies have been perfected over time, but their technological refinement falls short when it comes to illustrating the impact both had. Some 25 years ago, scientists at MIT's Media Lab told me about a paradigmatic change in computer technology. In the future, they said, the number of other computers connected to a computer will be more important than the number of transistors on its integrated circuits. To a writer interested in but not part of the forefront of computer technology, that was groundbreaking news. A few years later, the demonstration of a Mosaic browser was as formative for me as listening to the first Beatles record and seeing the first man on the moon had been for my parents. Changes since have been so multi-layered, interconnected, and rapid that comprehension has lagged behind. Scientific, social, and political changes occur in random patterns. Results have been mixed in equally random patterns. The slowdown of the music industry and media has not been matched in the publishing and film industry. The failed Twitter revolution in Iran had much in common with the Arab Spring, but even in the Maghreb, the results differed wildly. Social networks have affected societies sometimes in exactly opposite ways. Whereas the fad of social networks has resulted in cultural isolation in Western society, it has created a counterforce of collective communication against the strategies of the Chinese party apparatus to isolate its citizenry from within. Most of these phenomena have only been observed, not yet explained. It's mostly in hindsight that a linear narrative is constructed. The inability of many of the greatest digital innovations, like viral videos or social networks, to be monetized is just one of many proofs of how difficult it is to get a comprehensive grasp of digital history. Moore's Law and its numerous popular applications to other fields of progress thus create an illusion of predictability in the least predictable of all fields, the course of history. These errors of reasoning will be amplified if Moore's Law is allowed to come to its natural end. Peak theories have become the lore of cultural pessimism. If Moore's Law is allowed to become a finite principle, digital progress will be perceived as a linear progression toward a peak and an end. Neither will become a reality, because the digital realm is not a finite resource, but an infinite realm of mathematical possibilities reaching out into the analog world of sciences, society, economics, and politics. Because this progress has ceased to depend on a quantifiable basis and linear narratives, it won't be halted, not even slowed down, if one of its strains comes to an end. In 1972, the wheat and chessboard problem became the mythological basis for the Club of Rome's Malthusian limits to growth. The peaking of Moore's Law will create the illusion that the digital realm could be a world of limits and finite resources. This doomsday scenario could become as popular as the illusion of predictable advances it created. After all, there have never been loonies carrying signs saying, "The end is not near." The Continuity of Time. Ernst Poeppel, psychologist, neuroscientist, co-founder, Human Science Center, Munich University. Author, MindWorks. Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica by Isaac Newton is one of the fundamental works of modern science, and this is true not only for physics, but also for philosophy and the foundations of reasoning. Newton gives, in Scholium, the following definition: absolute, true, and mathematical time, of itself and from its own nature, flows equably without relation to anything external. The underlying concept of continuity of time is expressed in mathematical formulas describing, for instance, physical processes. This concept of continuity is almost never questioned. The Newtonian concept of the continuity of time is also implicitly assumed by Immanuel Kant when he refers to time as an a priori form of perception in his Critique of Pure Reason. We read in the translation, "Time is not an empirical concept. For neither coexistence nor succession would be perceived by us if the representation of time did not exist as a foundation a priori. Time is a necessary representation lying at the foundation of all our intuitions." The concept of the continuity of time is also hidden in another famous quotation in psychology. William James writes in The Principles of Psychology, "In short, the practically cognized present is no knife edge, but a saddleback with a certain breadth of its own on which we sit perched and from which we look in two directions into time. The unit of composition of our perception of time is a duration, with a bow and a stern, as it were, a rearward and a forward-looking end. We seem to feel the interval of time as a whole, with its two ends embedded in it. Here we're confronted with the idea of a traveling moment, that is, a temporal interval of finite duration is moving gradually through physical time, and not jumping, again assuming continuity of time. But is it really true? And can it be used to understand neural and cognitive processes? This theoretical concept of continuity of time in biological and psychological processes, usually appearing as an implicit assumption or unasked question, is wrong. The answer is simple if one takes a look at the way organisms process information to overcome the complexity and temporal uncertainty of stimuli in the physical world. One source of complexity comes from stimulus transduction, which is principally different in the sensory modalities like audition or vision, taking less than 1 millisecond in the auditory system and more than 20 milliseconds in the visual system. Thus, auditory and visual signals arrive at different times in central structures of the brain. Matters become more complicated by the fact that the transduction time in the visual modality is flux-dependent, since surfaces with less flux require more transduction time at the receptor surface. Thus, to see an object with areas of different brightness, or to see somebody talking, different temporal availabilities of local activities within the visual modality and similarly, different local activities across the two modalities engaged in stimulus processing must be overcome. For intersensory integration, aside from these biophysical problems, physical problems also have to be considered. The distance of objects to be perceived is obviously never predetermined. Thus, the speed of sound, not of light, becomes a critical factor. At a distance of approximately 10 to 12 meters, transduction time in the retina, under optimal optical conditions, corresponds to the time the sound takes to arrive at the recipient. Up to this horizon of simultaneity, auditory information is earlier than visual information. Beyond this horizon, visual information arrives earlier in the brain. Again, there must be some kind of mechanism that overcomes the temporal uncertainty of information represented in the two sensory modalities. How can this problem be solved? The best way is for the brain to step out of the mode of continuous information processing. The brain has indeed developed specific mechanisms to reduce complexity and temporal uncertainty by creating system states, possibly using neuronal oscillations, within which Newtonian time does not exist. Within such system states, temporally and spatially distributed information can be integrated, as experimental evidence shows. These states are atemporal because the before and after relationship of stimuli processed within them is not defined or definable. This biological trick implies that time does not flow continuously, but jumps from one atemporal system state to the next. The Input-Output Model of Perception and Action. Andy Clark, philosopher, chair in logic and metaphysics, University of Edinburgh. Author, Supersizing the Mind. It's time to retire the image of the mind as a kind of cognitive couch potato. A passive machine that spends its free time just sitting there waiting for an input to arrive to enliven its day. When an input arrives, this view suggests, the system swings briefly into action, processing the input and preparing some kind of output. The response, which might be a motor action or some kind of decision, categorization, or judgment. Output delivered, the cognitive couch potato in your head slumps back awaiting the next stimulation. The true story looks to be almost the reverse. Naturally intelligent systems, humans, other animals, are not passively awaiting sensory stimulation. Instead, they are constantly active, trying to predict the streams of sensory stimulation before those arrive. When an input, itself a dodgy notion, occurs, our proactive cognitive systems have already been busy predicting its shape and implications. Systems like that are already, pretty much constantly, poised to act, and all they need to process are any sense deviations from the predicted state. Action itself needs to be reconceived. Action is not so much a response to an input, input, output, stop, as a neat and efficient way of selecting the next input, driving a rolling cycle. These hyperactive systems are constantly predicting their own upcoming states and moving about so as to bring some of those states into being. In this way, we bring forth the evolving streams of sensory information that keep us viable, fed, warm, and watered, and serve our increasingly recondite ends. As ever-active prediction engines, these kinds of minds are not fundamentally in the business of solving puzzles given to them as inputs. Rather, they're in the business of keeping us one step ahead of the game, poised to act, and actively eliciting the sensory flows that keep us viable and fulfilled. Just about every aspect of the passive input-output model is thus false. We aren't cognitive couch potatoes so much as proactive predictivores, forever trying to stay one step ahead of the incoming waves of sensory stimulation. Keeping this in mind will help us design better experiments, build better robots, and appreciate the deep continuities binding life and mind.
Knowing is half the battle. Laurie R. Santos, Associate Professor of Psychology, Director, Comparative Cognition Laboratory, Yale University. Tamar Gendler, Vincent J. Scully, Professor of Philosophy, Professor of Psychology and Cognitive Science, Deputy Provost for Humanities and Initiatives, Yale University. Children of the 1980s, like the younger of these co-authors, may fondly remember a TV cartoon called G.I. Joe, whose closing conceit, a cheesy public service announcement, remains a much-parodied YouTube sensation almost 30 years later. Following each of these moralizing pronouncements came the show's famous epithet, "Now you know, and knowing is half the battle." While there may be some domains where knowing is half the battle, there are many more where it is not. Recent work in cognitive science has demonstrated that knowing is a shockingly tiny fraction of the battle for most real-world decisions. You may know that $19.99 is pretty much the same as $20, but the first still feels like a significantly better deal. You may know that a prisoner's guilt is independent of whether you're hungry or not, but you'll still seem like a better parole candidate when you've recently had a snack. You may know that a job applicant of African descent is as likely to be as qualified as one of European descent, but the negative aspects of the former's resume will still stand out. And you may know that a piece of fudge shaped like dog shit will taste delicious, but you'll still be hesitant to eat it. The lesson of much contemporary research in judgment and decision-making is that knowledge, at least in the form of our consciously accessible representation of a situation, is rarely the central factor controlling our behavior. The real power of online behavioral control comes not from knowledge, but from things like situation selection, habit formation, and emotion regulation. This is a lesson that therapy has taken to heart, but one that pure science continues to neglect. And so the idea cognitive science needs to retire is what we'll call the G.I. Joe fallacy, the idea that knowing is half the battle. It needs to be retired not just from our theories of how the mind works, but also from our practices of trying to shape minds to work better. You might consider this old news. After all, thinkers for the last 2,500 years have been pointing out that much of human action isn't under rational control. Don't we know by now that the G.I. Joe fallacy is just that, a fallacy? Well, yeah, we know, but... The irony is that knowing the G.I. Joe fallacy is a fallacy is, as the fallacy would predict, less than half the battle. As is knowing that people tend to experience $19.99 as a significantly lower price than $20. Even if you know about this left digit anchoring effect, the first item will still feel like a better deal. Even if you know about ego depletion effects, the prisoner you encounter after lunch will still seem like a better candidate for parole. Even if you know that implicit bias is likely to affect your assessment of a resume's quality, you will still deem the African-American candidate less qualified than the Caucasian. And even if you know about Paul Rozin's disgust work, you will still hesitate to drink Dom Perignon out of a sterile toilet bowl. Knowing isn't half the battle for most cognitive biases, including the G.I. Joe fallacy. Simply recognizing that the G.I. Joe fallacy exists is insufficient to avoid its grasp. So now you know. And that's less than half the battle.
Information Overload. Jay Rosen, Associate Professor of Journalism, New York University. We should retire the idea that goes by the name of information overload. It's no longer useful. The internet scholar Clay Shirsky puts it well. There's no such thing as information overload. There's only filter failure. If your filters are bad, there's too much to attend to and never enough time. These aren't trends powered by technology. They're conditions of life. Filters in a digital world work not by removing what needs removing, but simply by not selecting for it. The unselected material is still there, ready to be let through by someone else's filter. Intelligent filters, which is what we need, come in three kinds. A smart person who takes in a lot and tells you what you need to know. The ancient term for this is editor. The front page of the New York Times still works this way. An algorithm that sifts through the choices other smart people have made, ranks them, and presents you with the top results. That's how Google works, more or less. A machine learning system that over time gets to know your interests and priorities and filters the world for you in a smarter and smarter way. Amazon uses systems like that. Here's the best definition of information I know of. Information is a measure of uncertainty reduced. The definition is deceptively simple. In order to have information, you need two things. An uncertainty that matters. We're having a picnic tomorrow. Will it rain? And something that resolves it. The weather report. But some information creates the uncertainty that needs solving. Suppose we learn from news reports that the National Security Agency broke encryption on the Internet. That's information. It reduces uncertainty about how far the U.S. government was willing to go. All the way. But the same report increases uncertainty about whether there will continue to be a single Internet, setting us up for more information when that larger picture becomes clearer. So, information is a measure of uncertainty reduced, but also of uncertainty created. Which is probably what we mean when we say, well, that raises more questions than it answers. Filter failure occurs not from too much information, but from too much incoming stuff that neither reduces existing uncertainty nor raises questions that count. The likely answer is to combine the three types of filtering: smart people who do it for us, smart crowds and their choices, smart systems that learn by interacting with us as individuals. At this point, someone usually shouts out, "What about serendipity?" That's a fair question. We need filters that listen to our demands, but also let through what we have no way of demanding because we don't know about it yet. Filters fail when they know us too well, and when they don't know us well enough.
The Rational Individual. Alex Sandy Pentland, Toshiba Professor of Media, Arts, and Sciences, MIT, Director, MIT's Human Dynamics Laboratory and Media Lab Entrepreneurship Program, author, Social Physics, How Good Ideas Spread. Researchers argue about the extent to which people are rational, but the real problem with the concept of the rational individual is that our desires, preferences, and decisions are not primarily the result of individual thinking. Because economics and much of cognitive science take the unit of analysis to be an independent individual, they have difficulty accounting for such social phenomena as financial bubbles, political movements, panics, technology trends, or even the course of scientific progress. Near the end of the 1700s, philosophers began to declare that humans were rational individuals. People were flattered by being recognized as individuals and by being called rational, and the idea soon wormed its way into the belief systems of nearly everyone in upper-class Western society. Despite resistance from church and state, this idea of rational individuality replaced the assumption that truth came only from God and King. Over time, the ideas of rationality and individualism changed the entire belief system of Western intellectual society, and today it's doing the same to the belief systems of other cultures. Recent research data from my lab and other labs are changing this argument, and we're now coming to realize that human behavior is determined as much by social context as by rational thinking or individual desires. Rationality, as economists use the term, means that an individual knows what he or she wants and acts to get it. But this new research shows that in this regard, social network effects often, and perhaps typically, dominate both the desires and the decisions of individuals. Recently, economists have moved toward the idea of bounded rationality, which means that we have biases and cognitive limitations that prevent us from realizing full rationality. Our dependence on social interactions, however, isn't simply a bias or a cognitive limitation. Social learning is an important method of enhancing individual decision-making. Similarly, social influence is central to constructing the social norms enabling cooperative behavior. Our ability to survive and prosper is due to social learning and social influence at least as much to individual rationality. These data tell us that what we want and value, and how we choose to act in order to obtain our desires, are a constantly evolving property of interactions with other people. Our desires and preferences are mostly based on what our peer community agrees is valuable, rather than on rational reflection based directly on our individual biological drives or inborn morals. For instance, after the Great Recession of 2008, when many houses were suddenly worth less than their mortgages, researchers found that it took only a few people walking away from their houses and mortgages to convince many of their neighbors to do the same, a behavior that had previously been thought of as nearly criminal or immoral. Purposely defaulting on a mortgage now became common. To use the terminology of economics, in most things we're collectively rational, and only in some areas are we individually rational. By mathematically modeling the social learning and social pressure among people, my colleagues and I have been able to accurately model and predict crowd phenomena such as this cascade of mortgage defaulting. Importantly, we've also found that it's possible to shape real-world crowd behaviors by using social network incentives that alter the connections between people, and that these social incentives are much more effective than standard individual economic incentives. In one particularly striking example, we were able to use social network incentives to deflate a groupthink bubble among foreign exchange traders, and consequently double the return on investment of the individual traders. So instead of individual rationality, we have common sense. The collective intelligence of a community comes from the surrounding flow of ideas and examples. We learn from others in our environment, and those others learn from us. Over time, a community with members who actively engage with one another creates a group with shared, integrated habits and beliefs. When the flow of ideas incorporates a constant stream of outside ideas as well, then the individuals in the community make better decisions than they could on their own. This idea of a collective intelligence that develops within communities is an old one. Indeed, it is embedded in the English language. Consider the word kith, familiar to modern English speakers from the phrase kith and kin. Derived from Old English and Old German words for knowledge, kith refers to a more or less cohesive group with common beliefs and customs. These are also the roots for couth, which means possessing a high degree of sophistication, as well as its more familiar counterpart, uncouth. Thus, our kith is the circle of peers, not just friends, from whom we learn the correct habits of action. Our ancestors understood that our culture and the habits of our society are social contracts, and that both depend primarily on social learning. Thus, we learn most of our public beliefs and habits by observing the attitudes, actions, and outcomes of peers rather than by using logic or argument. Learning and reinforcing this social contract enables a group of people to coordinate their actions effectively. It's time we dropped the fiction of individuals as the unit of rationality and recognized that we are embedded in the surrounding social fabric. Homo Economicus. Margaret Levy, Director, Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences and Professor of Political Science, Stanford University. Co-author, with John Alquist, In the Interest of Others. Homo Economicus is an old idea and a wrong idea, deserving a burial of pomp and circumstance, but a burial nonetheless. People can be individualistic and selfish, yes, and under some circumstances narrowly focused on economic well-being. But even those most closely associated with the concept never fully believed it. Hobbes argued that people prefer to act according to the golden rule, but that their circumstances often made it difficult. Without rule of law, and in a world of theft and predation, people act with defensive selfishness. Adam Smith, whose invisible hand required individual pursuit of narrow interest, recognized that individuals have emotions, sentiments, and morals that influence their thinking. Even Milton Friedman was not sure whether narrowly selfish individualism was a correct assumption about human behavior. He didn't care whether the supposition was right or wrong, but only whether it was useful. It no longer is. The theories and models derived from the assumption of Homo economicus generally depend on a second, equally problematic assumption, full rationality. Related but distinct sets of scientific findings make suspect each piece of the pairing of narrowly selfish motivation with rational action. Philosophers such as Nietzsche and psychoanalytic theorists such as Sigmund Freud argued that people acted in a whole variety of ways that were explicable, perhaps, but were closer to animal instincts than calculative instrumentality. Herbert Simon and certainly David Kahneman and Amos Tversky revealed the extent to which cognitive limitations undermine rational calculations. Even if individuals can do no better than satisfice, that wonderful Simon term, they might still be narrowly self-interested, albeit, because of cognitive limitations, ineffective in achieving their ends. This perspective, which is at the heart of Homo economicus, must also be laid to rest. Darwin and those influenced by him long recognized that our species, like others, is altruistic at least in the narrow sense of acting to preserve one's gene pool by protecting one's young. Most people do more than that. The overwhelming finding of experimental research confounds the presumption that given the opportunity, individuals usually free ride. Indeed, most act according to norms of fairness and reciprocity. Many will make small sacrifices or forego larger returns, and some will even engage in costly action, up to a point, to do the right thing. Anthropologists and biologists have long provided evidence of the human animal as a social animal. The understanding that individuals are in social networks and communities opens the door to more complex models of reciprocity and ethical obligation. Consequently, social scientists can now account for aggregate outcomes they otherwise could not. Large-scale volunteering for the military in times of war, protest behavior, and contributions to public good. The rejection of Homo economicus doesn't mean a total absence of conditions under which narrow self-interest dominates. Experiments suggest very different socializations can produce quite distinct reasoning. Economics graduate students are far more likely to free ride than other students. At least two sets of circumstances can induce individualistic selfishness and significantly narrow a person's community of fate, that is, those with whom one feels interdependent and whom one feels an obligation to help. The first is extreme poverty, and the second, extreme competition. Those suffering hunger and deprivation tend to focus on meeting their own needs. As the growing number of dystopian novels suggests, the result may be theft and murder in the interest of obtaining food, shelter, and security. The classic experiments with rats come to the same conclusions. Extreme competition, at the least, narrows focus to the goal at hand. In some forms, however, striving to be king of the hill, and sometimes literally to be king, does provoke something akin to a Hobbesian world. Shakespeare, as he often does, captures the power of circumstance and ambition. His version of the War of the Roses is a testament to narrow, self-interested instrumentality dressed in the rhetoric of serving the country. Or witness the recent revelations about business ethics, or rather, lack of ethics. That people are often, perhaps more often than not, motivated to act beyond narrow self-interest is fully compatible with the importance of material incentives in motivating behavior. We're all susceptible to rewards, and we all fear punishment. Ceteris paribus, we prefer the first and wish to avoid the second. However, ethics, morality, and the obligations of reciprocity can affect our decisions even when there's considerable money at stake or serious threats to well-being. Few are willing to sacrifice everything for a cause or principle, but most of us are willing to sacrifice something. The reliance on Homo economicus as the basis of human motivation has given rise to a grand body of theory and research over the past 200 years. As an underlying assumption, it has generated some of the best work in economics. As a foil, it has generated findings about cognitive limitations, the role of social interactions, and ethically based motivations. The power of the concept of Homo economicus was once great, but its power has now waned, succeeded by new and better paradigms and approaches grounded in more realistic and scientific understandings of the sources of human action.
Don't discard wrong theories, just don't treat them as true. Richard H. Thaler, Charles R. Walgreen Distinguished Service Professor of Behavioral Science and Economics, Booth School of Business, University of Chicago. Co-author, with Cass R. Sunstein, Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness. I have a problem with this year's EDGE question, so I'll answer a somewhat different question. I suppose the intent of the question is to point to some ideas that have been definitively shown to be either wrong or unhelpful and thus should be dropped from our scientific lexicon. In economics, there are certainly many theories, hypotheses, and models that are badly flawed descriptions of the behavior of economic agents, so you might think I'd have many nominations for ideas that should be given funerals. But I don't. Most of these theories, while demonstrably poor descriptions of reality, are extremely useful as theoretical baselines. As such, it would be a mistake to declare them dead. Before getting to a couple of specific examples, I should stress that in economics, theories usually serve dual purposes. The first is normative, in the sense that it defines what a rational agent should do. The second is descriptive, that is, it's meant to be an accurate description of how firms actually behave. Economists use the same theory for both purposes, and this leads to problems. Consider the efficient market hypothesis, EMH, first elaborated by my Chicago colleague Eugene Fama, who recently received the Nobel Prize in Economics. The theory has two components. The first is that prices are unpredictable and you can't beat the market. I call this the no free lunch part of the EMH. The second is that asset prices are equal to fundamental value. I call this the price is right component. Ever since the EMH was formulated, it has been used as a baseline, null hypothesis in financial economics research. In a world consisting only of rational investors, both components would be descriptively accurate, but of course we don't live in such a world. How does the theory stand up in the real world? If I were fact-checking the no free lunch part of the theory, I'd score it mostly true. It is hard to beat the market, and most people who try fail, including professional mutual fund managers. The no free lunch component is only mostly true because sometimes you can beat the market, for example, by buying value stocks, whose prices seem low relative to earnings or assets. Still, a strategy of buying cheap index funds that track the market is a sensible one for investors to follow, so believing this part of the theory does little damage. The second component of the theory, the price is right, is both more important and more problematic. Two recent experiences, the tech stock bubble in the late 1990s and the real estate bubble in the early 2000s, reveal that prices can diverge to a significant degree from their intrinsic value. The late financial economist Fisher Black, co-inventor of the famous Black-Scholes option pricing formula, once conjectured that asset prices can diverge from their true values by a factor of two. Fisher, who died in 1995, might have revised that estimate to a factor of three had he lived to see the NASDAQ fall from 5,000 to 1,400 when the tech bubble burst. More than a decade later, the NASDAQ is only now reaching the 4,000 level with no adjustment for inflation. With the two components of the EMH graded partly wrong and badly wrong, should we abandon the theory? Hardly. None of the research done by behavioral finance researchers, including my fellow traveler Robert Shiller, who shared the 2013 Nobel Prize with Fama along with Lars Hansen, would have been possible without the EMH benchmark. Shiller's early research showed that prices were too variable compared to what would be expected in a rational model. So, if we shouldn't banish the EMH, what should change? The change I'd advocate is abolishing the presumption that it's true. Part of Alan Greenspan's reasoning, after hearing a talk from Shiller in 1996 warning of an overheated market, for the Fed not taking any action, was that bubbles were impossible in an efficient market. Even the Supreme Court, in the 1988 case Basic Incorporated versus Levinson, ruled that plaintiffs could rely on the official market hypothesis in bringing cases alleging misconduct by firms. The problem here is that users of this concept are neglecting the last word in the phrase efficient market hypothesis. The same mistake is made in the use of another theory that contributed to a Nobel Prize, Franco Modigliani's life cycle hypothesis. Here, the hypothesis is that people figure out how much they're going to make over their lifetime, how much they'll earn on their investments, how long they'll live, and then solve for the optimal amount to save each year while they're accumulating money, and similarly, at what rate to draw down their assets once they retire. Once again, this is a useful benchmark and can be helpful in offering advice to people regarding how much they should be saving for retirement. It would be a mistake to discard this theory, but it would be a much bigger mistake to presume it's true. The hypothesis counterfactually assumes that people are capable of solving a very difficult mathematical problem and also of implementing such a plan without falling victim to spending temptations along the way. Presuming the theory to be true induced many economists to confidently, but wrongly, predict that offering people retirement savings plans, such as 401ks, would have no effect on savings, since people were already saving the right amount, and would merely shift their saving into the new tax-favored plans, costing the government money, but producing no new saving. A similar presumption makes the false prediction that small changes, such as automatically enrolling participants, will have no effect on behavior. Let's keep these and many other wrong theories and hypotheses alive, but remember they're just hypotheses, not facts.
Rational Actor Models, The Competence Corollary. Susan Fisk, Eugene Higgins Professor, Psychology and Public Affairs, Princeton University. The idea that people operate mainly in the service of narrow self-interest is already moribund, as social psychology and behavioral economics have shown. We now know that people aren't rational actors, instead often operating on automatic, based on bias or happy with hunches. Still, it's not enough to make us into robots or to accept that we're flawed. The rational actor corollary, that all we need is to show more competence, should also be laid to rest. Even regular people who aren't classical economists sometimes think that sheer cutthroat competence would be enough, on the job, in the marketplace, in school, and even at home. Talent and problem-solving ability are crucial, of course, but there's more. We're social beings, embedded in a human environment even more than in a natural or a constructed one. If other people are our ecological niche, then we need to understand how to live among them. We do this by figuring out two things about them. Not only how good will they be at getting where they want to go, but also where are they trying to go? People are a miracle of self-propelled agency. Not for nothing are humans attuned to one another's intentions. We need, and our ancestors needed to know whether others have friendly or hostile intentions toward us. In my world, we call this a person's warmth, and others have called it trustworthiness, morality, communality, or worthy intentions. People are most effective in social life if they are, and show themselves to be, both warm and competent. This is not to say we always get it right, but the intent and the effort must be there. This is also not to say love is enough, because we do have to prove able to act on our worthy intentions. The warmth-competence combination supports both short-term cooperation and long-term loyalty. In the end, it's time to recognize that people survive and thrive with both heart and mind.
Malthusianism. Matt Ridley, science writer, founding chairman, International Center for Life. Author, The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves. T. Robert Malthus, he used his middle name, thought population must outstrip food supply unless checked by famine, disease, and war. So he warned that if people did not delay marriage, it would be necessary to court the return of the plague and particularly encourage settlements in all marshy and unwholesome situations. Alas, many people were only too happy to take up this nasty idea that you had to be cruel to be kind to prevent population growing too fast for food supply. It directly influenced heartless policy in colonial Ireland, British India, Imperial Germany, eugenic California, Nazi Europe, Lyndon Johnson's aid to India, and Deng Xiaoping's China. It was encountering the Club of Rome's Malthusian tract, The Limits to Growth, that led Sung Jian to recommend a one-child policy to Deng. The Malthusian misanthropic itch is still around and far too common in science. Yet Malthus's followers were wrong, wrong, wrong. Not just because they were unlucky that the world turned out nicer than they thought, not just because keeping babies alive proved a better way of getting birth rates down than encouraging them to die, not just because technology came to the rescue, but because Malthusians have repeatedly made the mistake of thinking of resources as static, finite things that would run out. They thought growth meant using up a fixed heap of land, metals, water, nitrogen, phosphate, oil, and so forth. They thought the birth of a calf was a good thing because it added to the world's resources, but the birth of a baby was a bad thing because it added to the mouths to feed. They completely misunderstood the nature of a resource, which only becomes a resource thanks to human ingenuity. So uranium oxide was not a resource before nuclear power. Shale oil was not a resource until horizontal fracking. Steel was not easily recyclable until the electric arc furnace. Nitrogen in the air was not a resource until the Haber process. The productivity of land was transformed by fertilizer. So globally, we now use 65% less land than we did 50 years ago to produce the same amount of food. And a baby is a resource, too. A brain as well as a mouth. The few economists, such as Julian Simon and Bjørn Lomborg, who tried to point this out to the Malthusian scientists, and who argued that economic growth was not the cumulative use of resources but the increase of productivity, doing more with less, were called imbeciles or had pies thrown in their face for their trouble. But they were right again and again, as population and prosperity grew together to levels that the Malthusians kept saying were impossible. It is unrealistic to assume that there will be increases in agricultural production adequate to meet forecast demands for food, said a long list of scientific stars in a British book called A Blueprint for Survival in 1972. Farmers can no longer keep up with rising demand, thus the outlook is for chronic scarcities and rising prices. And famine is inevitable, said Lester Brown in 1974. World food production has since doubled, and famine is largely history, except where dictators create it. World population will almost certainly cease to grow before the end of the century. Peak farmland is very close, if not already past. That is to say, we're using less farmland to grow more food, so we'll need less land, not more. Electric cars driven by nuclear power stations are, to all intents and purposes, an infinite resource. The world is a dynamic, reflexive place in which change is all. Time to retire the static, myopic, misanthropic mistakes done in the name of the mathematical Parson Malthus. Economic Growth. Cesar Hidalgo, Assistant Professor, MIT Media Lab, Faculty Associate, Center for International Development, Harvard University. Economic growth is one of those concepts nobody wants to contradict. Even its detractors cannot avoid using it. They talk about green growth, sustainable growth, and in the most extreme cases, they talk about degrowth. Yet economic growth, as a concept and a reality, is recent. Modern measures of economic growth are less than a century old, dating back to the invention of GDP by Simon Kuznets in the 1930s. Economists mostly agree that economies did not grow before the 19th century, so economic growth as a phenomenon is also recent. As do many others, I believe that the idea of economic growth is ready for retirement. The lingering question is what will replace it, since economic growth will leave a void in public speech as both a staple paragraph of political campaigns and a recurrent topic in news media. But economic growth cannot last forever. If the GDP per capita of the United States grew in real terms at a modest rate of 1% for the next millennium, the average American would be making a whopping $1.1 billion annually by the year 3014. A more reasonable interpretation of this number is to think of the growth during the last century as part of an S-shaped curve, a phase transition. This means either that growth will peter out during this millennium or that we're measuring the wrong thing. Either way, we can conclude that the idea of economic growth is on its way out. Unlimited and Eternal Growth. Hans-Ulrich Obrist, curator, Serpentine Gallery, London, co-author with Rem Koolhaas, Project Japan, Metabolism Talks, editor, Do It, The Compendium. While studying political economy during the late 1980s, I was deeply inspired by the pioneer of ecology and economics, Hans Christoph Binswanger, who is now in his 80s and is being rediscovered by younger artists and activists, for example, Tino Segal, who often cite him as an influence. The wisdom of Binswanger's work is that he recognized early that endless growth is unsustainable, both in human and planetary terms. The current focus in mainstream economics is, he argued, too much on labor and productivity and too little on natural and intellectual resources. Dependency on endless growth, as the crisis that always emerges at the end of each cyclical bull market should teach us, is unrealistic. Binswanger's goal was to investigate the similarities and differences between aesthetic and economic values through an examination of the historical relationship between economics and alchemy, which he made as interesting as it sounds, at first, outlandish. In his 1985 book, Money and Magic, he showed how the brash concept of unlimited growth was inherited from the medieval discourse of alchemy, the search for a process that could turn lead into gold. A focus of Binswanger's research has been on Goethe, especially his role in shaping social economics while finance minister at the court of Weimar. In Goethe's Faust, the eponymous character thinks in terms of infinite progress, while Mephisto recognizes the destructive potential of such an idea. At the beginning of part two of the play, Mephistopheles urges the ruler of an empire facing financial ruin because of profligate government spending to issue promissory notes thus solving its debt problems. Binswanger had been fascinated by the Faust legend since his childhood, and during his studies he discovered that Goethe's introduction of paper money into his play was inspired by the story of the Scottish economist John Law, who in 1716 was the first man to establish a French bank issuing paper money. Strikingly, after Law's innovation, the Duke of Orléans got rid of all his alchemists because he realized that the immediate availability of paper money was far more powerful than any attempt to turn lead into gold. Binswanger also connects money and art in a novel way. Art, he points out, is based on imagination and is part of the economy. While a bank's process of creating money in the form of promissory notes or coins is connected to imagination, since it's based on the idea of bringing into being something that has yet to exist. At the same time, a company imagines producing a certain good and needs money to realize this, so it takes out a loan from a bank. If the product is sold, the imaginary money that was created in the beginning has a countervalue in real products. In classical economic theory, this process can be continued endlessly. Binswanger recognizes, in Money and Magic, that this endless growth exerts a quasi-magical fascination. He produces a way of thinking about the problems of rampant capitalist growth, encouraging us to question the mainstream theory of economics and to recognize how it differs from the real economy. But instead of rejecting the market wholesale, he suggests ways in which to moderate its demands. Thus, the market doesn't have to disappear or be replaced, but can be understood as something to be manipulated for human purposes rather than obeyed. Another way of interpreting Binswanger's ideas is as follows. For most of human history, a fundamental problem has been the scarcity of material goods and resources, and so we have become ever more efficient in our methods of production and created rituals to enshrine the importance of objects in our culture. Less than a century ago, human beings made a world-changing transition through their rapacious industry. We now inhabit a world in which the overproduction of goods, rather than their scarcity, is one of our most fundamental problems. Yet our economy functions by inciting us to produce more and more with each passing year. In turn, we require cultural forms to enable us to sort through the glut, and our rituals are once again directed toward the immaterial, toward quality and not quantity. This requires a shift in our values, from producing objects to selecting among those that already exist. The Tragedy of the Commons. Luca De Biase, journalist, editor, Nova 24, Il Sole 24 Ore. The Tragedy of the Commons is at an end, thanks to the writings of the late Nobel laureate Eleanor Ostrom. But the well-deserved funeral has not been celebrated yet. Thus, some consequences of the now disproved theory proposed by Garrett Hardin in his famous 1968 article are still to be fully digested. Which is urgent, because some major problems we face in our age are very much related to the commons. Climate change, the issue of privacy and freedom on the Internet, the choice between copyright or public domain in scientific knowledge. Of course, the commons can be overexploited. But what's wrong with Hardin's theory is the notion of tragedy. By using that term, Hardin implied that a sort of destiny condemned the commons to be depleted. In his opinion, a big enough set of rational individuals who are free to choose will act in a way that will inevitably lead to the exhaustion of the commons, because free and rational individuals will always maximize their private advantage and collectivize the costs. Ostrom has demonstrated that this tragic destiny doesn't need to be true. She found all over the world an impressive number of cases in which communities run the commons in a sustainable way, getting the most out of them without depleting them. Ostrom's factual approach to the commons came with very good theory, too. Preconditions to the commons' sustainability were, in Ostrom's view, clarity of the law, methods of collective and democratic decision-making, local and public mechanisms of conflict resolution, and no conflicts among the various layers of government. These preconditions exist in many situations, and there is no tragedy there. Cultures that understand the commons are contexts that make a sustainable behavior rational. Hardin's approach, which he developed during the Cold War, was probably biased by ideological dualism. The commons didn't fit, as Ostrom noted in her Nobel lecture, in a dichotomous world of the market and the state, in a context in which private property and deregulation versus state-owned resources and regulation were seen as the only two possible solutions. The commons was considered a losing system, condemned to the past. But the Internet has become the biggest commons of knowledge in history. It would be difficult to argue that the Internet is a losing system. In the last 20 years, the commons of the Internet has changed the world. Of course, the Internet can be exploited by gigantic companies or state-owned secret services, but no tragic destiny condemns the Internet to ruin. To save it, we can start by understanding and preserving its rules, such as net neutrality, multi-stakeholder governance, and transparent enforcement of those rules and governance. Wikipedia has demonstrated that this is possible. There's no tragedy, but there are conflicts, and they can be better understood by embracing a vision open to Ostrom's notion of polycentric governance of complex economic systems. The danger of a closed vision, one that understands only the conflicts between state regulation and market freedom, seems even more catastrophic when you contemplate climate change and other environmental issues. With regard to the environment, the commons idea seems a much more generative notion than many others. It doesn't guarantee a solution, but it's a better starting point. The tragedy of the commons theory has now become a comedy. But it can be a sad comedy if we don't finish with it and move on.